being close to the beach, you're kind of reminded every day that there's got to be something bigger than you. And so people were more religious or more spiritual, I think. In Atlanta, I'm meeting a lot of skeptics, just a lot of them. And I think it's also a cultural trend. I think if I went back to San Diego right now, I would see that there's probably quite a few secular atheistic people there as well. So I think it's a cultural trend. But what I want to do is kind of show you in an overview sort of way what I do over the course of about 5 or 6 discussions with some skeptics. And the reason that I want to do this as a sermon for you guys is maybe this will help you have another tool to have some ideas on how to have conversations with people. I'll say more about that at the end of the lesson. But maybe you're struggling with your belief right now. And you're wondering if Christianity is something that's worth thinking about, if it's something that is worth keeping in your life. And so hopefully some of the things that we look at this morning will help you with that. I want to begin this lesson, though, by looking at some statistics about what's happening in our society right now. It shouldn't be a surprise to us right now that religious interest is on the decline. These statistics that I'm about to show you are true for the United States. When religion is not on the decline across the world, it's on the decline in the United States. And so about 2 years ago, Pew Research had an article that was titled, "In the United States, Decline of Christianity Continues at a Rapid Pace." And here's some of the statistics that they had, that the religiously unaffiliated, and by the way, there's a range of religiously unaffiliated people. The strongest one would be the atheist, who is evangelistic about their belief that there is no God. So there's the atheist, then there's the agnostic, who says, "I'm not sure," and then there's just the religiously disinterested. So that's kind of the range of religiously unaffiliated. And 2 years ago, it was 26% of the United States. And in 2009, it was 17% of the United States. Now, can you guess over the last 2 years how much those numbers have gone up? Just recently, Gallup did an article, and the article showed that less than 50% of Americans now belong to a church. And in their article that they posted on this, they said the decline in church membership is primarily a function of the increasing number of Americans who express no religious preference. So in 2 years, you notice how much this religiously unaffiliated has gone up. So you look at these statistics and you go, the question that I think is worth asking is, well, what's the cause of this? Why is this happening? And I think one of the things that happened since the Enlightenment, the 1600s or so, that the human Enlightenment said that the human mind ought to be able to understand everything and give rationale for everything. So the more and more that we understand things scientifically, the less and less we're going to need religion to help us answer those things. I don't know if you've ever talked to a secular, skeptic, atheistic person. The mindset that sometimes they have is, I'm the one who's been enlightened, I'm the one who's come to understand reason and fact and science and biology and all of these different kinds of things, and you just have emotional reasons for why you want to be a Christian, but we have actual facts and data and statistics and all of these things like this. And what I posit, what I argue with the skeptics that I study with, is that you might think that, but if you reject a Christian worldview and you adopt a secular worldview, what you've done is you've traded one belief system that requires faith, which is Christianity, for another belief system which also requires faith. Whichever worldview you take, you're going to have to believe it by faith. Are there arguments for either side? Sure. So you have to ask the question, well, where do the arguments best lead? Now, it's ironic that skeptics might paint themselves as the people that are rational thinkers and logical, and they're the ones that know the science and everything like that. Are there emotional reasons for being an atheist? People would say there's emotional reasons for being a Christian. Are there emotional reasons for being an atheist? And does that come into play, actually, in the decision that you've made to reject a Christian worldview? Aldous Huxley, now by the way, whenever I do these studies with the atheists, what I've done is I have read a ton of atheists. What I'm doing right now this morning is not my typical sermon by any means. I like to normally just teach a section of scripture. But in order to study with the atheists, one of the things that I've done is I've read from a lot of other atheists so that I'm bringing up these quotes for the discussion because they already don't like the Bible. But if I can find atheists that make the points that I would like them to consider, then I find those quotes. And so Aldous Huxley was an atheist. And in 1937, he wrote a book called Ends and Means. And here's what he says. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world, by meaning he means, by the way, that there's no God that's created everything and therefore there's no transcendent meaning to my existence. He says that this person is not concerned exclusively with a problem in metaphysics. He is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. For myself, the philosophy of meaningless was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political. So he's saying a lot of words here, but he's saying that for the philosopher who tries to argue that the world is meaningless, that there's no God that we have to submit to or anything like that, that they're not just concerned with facts and data. You notice here he says that he's also concerned with liberation, being able to do what he wants to do sexually or politically or whatever. Now, with the atheists that I study with, one of the questions that I always ask, and I studied with one yesterday that grew up in a Christian family in Tennessee. We started doing a Zoom study yesterday morning. Is I'll ask the question, tell me about your deconversion from Christianity. Or tell me, like, what your religious experience was growing up. And every time it's something like, well, I grew up in a Christian family, but my parents were hypocrites, and it gave me a bad taste in my mouth. Or people at the church that I went to were really mean, or whatever. And so I'm trying to help them understand that the thing that started your unbelief was an emotional reaction to something. It wasn't that you started to get enlightened through facts and data and science. Those things came along after your heart detached from God. And then they made you feel good in the things that you were now believing, that you started to believe by emotion. So here's a question then. Every year, the Oxford English Dictionary has a word of the year. And the word of the year is supposed to, like, put a capstone on defining what the year was all about. And in 2016, the Oxford English Dictionary word of the year was post-truth. Post-truth. And the definition of post-truth is that we live in a society now that doesn't make decisions based on facts and data and analysis, but we make decisions and we understand what we believe about ourselves and about the world based on what feels right to us. And so what happens then if I'm studying with Mr. Atheist and we're across the table from each other and he goes, I don't believe in the Bible, I don't believe in God, blah, 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 all these kinds of arguments that we'd oftentimes hear. My initial instinct used to be to say, well, here's the arguments for God, and here's the reasons why we should trust the Bible, and here's the archaeological evidence for the Bible, and all of that stuff is completely valid. But what if I'm talking to somebody who's not really interested in facts and data, but what they're interested in is what they feel? How do you communicate the gospel to people in a society like that? So what I've done is this different approach that I'm going to share right now. If people have emotional reasons for not believing in God, does God have emotional reasons for why we should believe in Him? And are emotions part of the decision-making process that we have? Yeah, but does it definitively prove everything? No, but this is one argument, we'll see how this works, that Christianity fits our deepest needs. All of us have needs, and we're going to go through four of them. All of us have needs, whether you're a Christian or an atheist. And so what I do when I study with atheists is I say, okay, let's start out with the first need that we're going to talk about is our need to have meaning in life. Everybody wants to have a sense of meaning in life. So here's the question. Which worldview gives you meaning? Is it the atheistic worldview or is it the Christian worldview? And then I do the same thing with several different needs that everybody would agree that they know that they have. And as we do that, I'm trying to help them understand that Christianity fits your needs like a glove, And you should actually want Christianity to be true, changing their emotions against Christianity towards it. So you'll see how this works as we go through this. The first need that I discuss with them is our need for meaning. Everybody, whether you're a Christian or an atheist, knows that they would like to have some kind of sense of meaning. What does meaning mean? How do you know if you have meaning in life? Well, part of understanding meaning is looking backwards, that I'm here for a purpose. So I look back to my origins, where I came from, and that informs what my purpose is. But we also want to know that what we do has a lasting impact. So I'm looking backwards to where I came from and why I'm here, and I'm looking forward to what kind of impact am I going to have when I die. Stephen Jay Gould is an atheist, and in Life magazine, he wrote this quote about the atheistic understanding of how they get meaning. So here's what Stephen Jay Gould said. "We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Because the earth never froze entirely during an ice age. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We must construct these answers for ourselves." So you see here, if you're talking to this guy, if you could interview him today, you say, okay, so what is the meaning in life? You'd say, well, there's really no greater answer other than we got lucky because during one of the ice ages, it didn't freeze entirely and destroy everything. And one day, there was a fish that finned its way up, or whatever, I don't know how that works. It finned its way up onto the dry land, and then it found another fish that happened to fin its way up too, and they were somehow able to mate or whatever. You see what his point is? That we just got lucky. And so because of that, there's no transcendent meaning. There's no ultimate meaning in life. I just finished a book last night from another atheist named Catherine Osmond. And she goes through this whole kind of journey to try to figure out, how do I find meaning in everything without God? And at the end of the book, she said, I still found that there's no meaning. Which skeptics and atheists are okay saying, because what does Stephen Jay Gould say in this quote? That this might be really troubling, but it's actually liberating to say that there's no meaning in life. Because I get to construct my own sense of what my meaning in life is. So whenever I study with the atheists, this is one of the quotes that I bring up, and I say, do you guys think this is accurately portraying your worldview? And they say, yeah, no transcendent meaning, but we do get to figure out meaning for ourselves. And then the follow-up question is, okay, well, what's your meaning then? What have you made it to be? And some of them will say, well, it's my family, or it's my career. The book that I finished last night, the final paragraph of the book, was this woman that was arguing in this line of thought that there's no objective meaning. But she told this story of her little daughter going out to get the newspaper and then walking back to the house. And she looked at her daughter's beautiful blue eyes. And she said, this is my meaning in life, is my family. You know what the problem of that is? One car accident can take your meaning in life away. If your meaning in life is your career, all it takes is for you to mess up and you're fired. Do you know how fragile life is if you put your meaning in things in this life? And how if you're trying to build your meaning in life on all kinds of things that can be taken away from you? Thieves and robbers can come and break in and take your meaning in life. Do you see how fragile that is? So what is the Christian perspective or the Christian worldview on a sense of meaning? What's the first thing that the Bible says about human beings? That they're made in God's image. Do you know where else that word for image is used in the Bible? It's used, for example, in Ezekiel, where God told the Israelites, don't make any images of any gods. Were the Israelites supposed to not make any images? Yeah. But at the beginning of the Bible, did God make an image of himself? He did. Do you know what it was? Do you know what it is? It's human beings. Because if I try to carve out an image of God, emphasizing his power, and I make a bull with big horns, the only thing that I'm emphasizing is his strength, but I'm not emphasizing his love or his compassion or anything of that nature. The only thing that God made that can adequately image God is a human being. So you've been dignified, every human being, made in the image of God, has the capacity to image him and show the world what he looks like in our character. But also, the choices that we make have eternal impacts. When I encourage other people, when I'm serving people, when I'm teaching people the gospel, the thing that I'm doing in the life of other people could have eternal impact. It goes beyond whatever the secular worldview would give. By the way, if suffering and trials can take away meaning in the secular worldview, does suffering and trials for the Christian take away our meaning? 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 20 and 22, for what credit is it if when you sin and you are beaten for it, you endure? But if you, when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. If our meaning in life is to be imagers of God and to bring glory to God and help other people know about God, suffering can never take me away from that purpose. It actually drives me deeper into that purpose. So, for the question of meaning in life, does Christianity kind of get that check mark? I think so. That's the first one. Now, by the way, I do a whole hour-long discussion on this, so I'm really going through this very quickly. But the second need that I discuss with the skeptics is our need for identity. So all of us have different hats that we wear. So I'm a husband, I'm a preacher, I'm a father, I'm a brother, I'm a son. We all have different hats that we wear. And depending on who we're interacting with, we do act a little bit differently for the role that we're in presently. That doesn't mean that we're hypocrites, by the way. What your identity is what is identical about you in every hat that you wear. So if I'm a father, preacher, husband, whatever, what's the core thing that's true about me in all of those scenarios? That's your identity. And so there's the traditional approach to identity. The traditional approach to identity works from the outside in. There's cultures today that have this form of understanding who you are. What happens in these cultures is you figure out who you are based on what everybody around you expects of you. And even if you don't like it, you submit to it and work it into your heart. So, for example, if you grew up in the 1500s and your dad was a farmer or a fisherman, what was expected of you? That you become a farmer or a fisherman. But what if you're going, well, I'd really like to be a painter, or I'd really like to be an architect. I'm sorry, but that's really, you kind of have to stuff that and be okay with what everybody expects outside of you, and then you have to submit yourself to that. So that's how a traditional approach to identity works. There's the modern approach, which is the exact opposite. The exact opposite approach is what we live in our society, where it starts from the inside and works to the outside. In other words, I start with who do I think I am? If I'm a man, do I think I'm a woman, for example? Whatever it could be. I think I'm this or that. And you all better be okay with it. Rather than the society saying this, and I better learn to be okay with it, it's me saying, this is who I am, and you all better be okay with it. By the way, one of the most sophisticated quotes that I bring up in the studies with the atheists is from the movie Frozen. The song, Let It Go, it shifts from a traditional approach to a modern approach of identity. So remember, I'm not going to sing this, but you remember this well, that Elsa says, don't let them in, don't let them see, be the good girl you always have to be, conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. What is Elsa saying? Like, there's things about me that I don't want everybody else to know, so I just conceal it, just stuff it. That's the traditional approach to identity. But the modern approach, inside out, you know when the song becomes just beautiful and amazing? Is when she switches to the modern approach. Now, you'll never think about this movie the same way again. But she says, Elsa goes on to say this, well, now they know. They know what's in my heart. Let it go, can't it hold it back anymore. Let it go, turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to say. That's the modern approach. Do you see how the song switches from the traditional approach to the modern approach? And it becomes like an upbeat song and all this kind of stuff once we start talking about the modern approach that we should all be on board with. Okay, so if this is the society we live in, that I'm going to figure out who I am, and you all better like it, what's the problem with that? Well, there's a couple problems with this. Actually, I had a friend from high school that transitioned from being a man to a woman. And he just detransitioned. He just went back. And I was on the phone with him this last week for about 45 minutes. And some of what he said fits in exactly with this. One of the problems with this approach to understanding who you are is that our desires are constantly changing. Do we ever have desires that we'd say, yeah, I feel this about myself? Like things that are contradictory. Like let's say, for example, that I want to really move up very high in my career. And in order to do that, I need to move to a big city that's not very conducive to having kids and a family and stuff like that. But I also want to have kids and a family. Can you have those two desires and not really be able to have the fulfillment of both of them? Because they're sort of in contradiction to each other. Or, like my friend from high school, can you feel like you're a woman for a couple of years and then go, actually, no, that's really not right? The problem with me determining for myself who I am and demanding everybody respect it is that my views about myself change so often. And so that's not going to be really reliable. But there's another problem with this, is that this modern approach really becomes an illusion. It actually becomes the traditional approach. Because if in our society right now, people say, be true to yourself, be true to yourself, be true to yourself. And I go, okay, I'm a Christian. Can I be true to myself? No, not that one. It's just, our society is just pushing certain agendas. They don't really care about being true to yourself because why do you have persecution? Why do you have Christians being maligned and all this kind of thing? So that, it really doesn't work that way anyways. All right, so what is the Christian approach to understanding yourself? The most succinct passage that I can think of in the Bible is in 1 Corinthians 4 when Paul is arguing to the Corinthian Christians about how they should think about preachers. Remember, they have their groupies over who their favorite preacher is. And it's not just, well, this is the guy I prefer. It's like, well, we're going to actually divide over who my favorite one is. And Paul is writing about how the church should look at preachers. And so he says this in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 and 4. But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. So notice how he first of all rejects the traditional approach to identity. He says, it's a small thing what all of you think about me. Could we really say that, honestly? It's a small thing what other people think about me. Small thing. Maybe it bothers me a little bit, but it's really just a small thing. Doesn't matter too much. Now, he doesn't just say, well, it's a small thing. I don't care what you guys think about me. You'd expect him to say, I only care what I think about me. But did you notice that he doesn't say that either? He says in verse 4, I'm not aware of anything against myself. In other words, in my conscience, I'm not aware that I've done anything I shouldn't have done. So I feel pretty good about what I'm doing right now. My conscience is clean. But did you notice that he says, I still don't care about that either, though? Because it's the Lord that acquits me. It's the Lord that judges me. So the uniqueness of Christianity, do all of us need some kind of understanding of who we are from outside of ourselves? Yeah, societies don't do a good job of that. But what if there was a creator of all the universe who's totally benevolent and powerful? And he says that you're a priest, and he says that you're adopted, and he says that you're loved. And he says that you're forgiven. And all of these different titles that he's given us in the scriptures, I talked about some of those a couple weeks ago, that's far better than depending on what people think about you or you taking your unreliable emotions and trying to define yourself based on those. So that's the second need, is identity. The third one is our need for morality. All of us have some kind of sense of moral obligation. Moral obligation meaning that I wouldn't just go ahead and say, well, murder is wrong for me, but if that's what your preference is, then that's okay. It's not like your favorite ice cream flavors. Like, I like vanilla, you might like strawberry or whatever, and that's fine for you. Moral obligation is, I think it's wrong for me, and I think it's wrong, and I think it's wrong for everybody. So, what would the secular approach to having moral obligation be? Why do secular people care about morality? By the way, before I get into this a little bit more, my argument with the skeptics is not that atheists can never do morally good things. Have you ever seen atheists do morally good things? They can. Now, what their motive is a whole other question. That's something I'm not going to get into with them. But atheists can do moral things. My contention with them is, why do you care about doing morally good things? Why does your worldview give you a concern for morality? And so the secular approach to this, there's two main arguments that the secular people would say, this is why we care about morality. Number one is people would say that morality came about from naturalistic evolution. That just as evolution created our eyes and our teeth and our hands so that we can survive and all this kind of stuff, what evolution eventually created was a need to care for the poor. Now, there's a couple problems with that. The first problem is that if evolution is the strong eating the weak, how do you suddenly from evolution get the strong helping the weak? That's the exact opposite of what the worldview says. In fact, I just started reading Charles Darwin's The Descent of Man a couple weeks ago. So Charles Darwin, his famous book is The Origin of the Species, about all the things that he did. The Descent of Man is his book about dating. Not like fossil dating, but like who you should marry. And throughout the book, he talks about people from Africa, and he talks about people from Australia as anthropomorphous apes. And he says that such people should be wiped out. This is what Charles Darwin said. And so in his worldview, there are different races of people. Some are weaker than others. And then the biblical worldview says everybody's made in God's image. But where did Hitler get his ideas? From the Bible? Or from this idea that there are weaker races and our ethics don't become helping the weak, our ethics become killing the weak so that the breeding pools can be what they ought to be. This is what Charles Darwin said. Go read The Descent of Man. So you can't say that morality has come about from naturalistic evolution when naturalistic evolution says to destroy the weak. There's a second problem though with morality coming from evolution. Thomas Nagel is an atheist who wrote a book about why evolution is a flawed theory. And in the book, he said this: if evolutionary biology is a physical theory, as it is generally taken to be, then it cannot account for the appearance of consciousness and of other phenomena that are not physically reducible. So here's the point. The atheist that I studied with yesterday morning, he's a determinist. You know what a determinist is? It means that you don't ever make conscious free will decisions. Is that every decision he makes, everything he says, are just chemicals firing in his brain that were set off by the Big Bang. So determinism is that you don't really have any free will. You have the appearance of consciousness, but it's not really even a real thing. Thomas Nagel, as he's writing here, says, okay, if evolutionary biology is generally taught to be a physical thing, it's just chemicals in your brain firing, how can a physical process create immaterial things like consciousness? Consciousness is not a physical part of my brain. If I think about a red banana in my mind right now, if somebody was to crack open my skull, could they find a red banana in there somewhere? It's an immaterial thought. So how can evolution, which is a physical process, create an immaterial thing? It can't derive that. So there's a problem with that. That's the first approach to why secular people would care about morality, is that it's come from evolution. No, it doesn't. Second approach is that morality comes from social consensus or social contract theory. That if a society says that this, that, or the other thing is what we believe, then that's what we're going to go with. There's obvious problems with that. 1,000 years ago, most societies believed that slavery was okay. So that means it would be wrong for us to criticize those societies that did that, because that's what they decided in their time, and it was okay for them. Or Nazi Germany. Most people, a lot of people, the social consensus in Nazi Germany was that we have to destroy the weak so that we can have the better breeding pools. So can we criticize them? Is it okay to do that? If social contract theory is true, then we can't. What is it that Christianity offers with regards to morality? One of the biggest arguments people make about not being Christians is that Christians are hypocrites. That Christians are not moral people, but they claim all these kind of morals and stuff like this. I'm not arguing that Christians are always the most moral people. By the way, Christians are the best people I've ever known. But my argument is that Christianity offers us the best resources to be moral. I'm not saying every Christian is always going to live up to it. But what does Christianity offer with regards to why we should care about morality? All right, here's this this clickatizer, whatever this thing is called. So here's the clickatizer made by Kensington. So let's say that I've got some deck boards on our backyard that some of the nails are starting to come up, so I'm starting to change the deck boards out as I have time to. So some of the nails are coming up. What if I took this Clickitizer and I saw some of those nails coming up, I started pounding the nails back in and this thing shatters. And then I call Kensington and I say, you guys make terrible Clickitizers. Well, they'd say, well, what did you do with the Clickitizer? I
forget what this is called.
And so I call them and I say, well, you guys make really bad products. And they say, well, what were you doing with it? I said, I was trying to pound some nails with it. They said, well, that's not what it's made for. How can you assess the Clickitizer if you don't even know what it's for? You know what's interesting in our society is people talk about, oh, he's a good person, she's a bad person, she's a good person, she's a, whatever, you know, whatever. But if you're a secular person and you don't even know why we're here, how can you assess who's good and bad if you don't know what our purpose is? You don't even have the right to assess if somebody's good or bad if you don't know what your purpose is. So Christianity has a clear purpose that we're made in God's image, like we said before. Your purpose is to be a reflection of God. And that means that if we're supposed to be a reflection of God, our morality comes from God's character. God is loving, so we're loving. God is holy, so we're loving, or we're holy. We derive all of our sense of morality from what he says about himself because we're supposed to try to imitate that. And so the Christian approach to morality, very clear, coming from a transcendent moral order, from a being that is moral, and then we try to imitate that. So that's our sense of morality. Now the last one is our need for hope. All of us live every present moment in anticipation of what we believe about the future. Do you suppose, by the way, that our society is doing a pretty good job of instilling hope? I don't think so. Suicide rates have more than doubled in the last few years. Have you ever noticed how the art of a society kind of reflects the demeanor of a society? Remember before the Rona happened and like Hollywood was still making movies and all that kind of stuff? One of the later trends, most recent trends, was the dystopian movies. Hunger Games, Divergent, which they didn't end up making all the movies because it didn't do as well. But like there's other movies that are very dark. The birth rate in the United States is at an all-time low right now, which oftentimes is traced to people not having hope in the future of a nation or whatever. And so what is the secular approach to finding hope, especially in a society that's not doing a very good job of instilling it? The secular approach to finding hope is that some people will say, well, my hope is that I'll leave the world a better place. That when I die, that there'll be some kind of contribution that I made, and it'll really have made a positive impact in the life of somebody else. Alright? Do you suppose there's some people that have died and left a good legacy? Yeah. But do you think some of those people will be forgotten after another 500 years is over or something? Ecclesiastes chapter 1 verse 15 says, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. There are some things that you can try to solve in this world, but it will always be crooked. There's all kinds of examples of this. But you try to overhaul one thing and then other people get in charge of something and then they're just as wicked as the other people. There's always going to be wicked. I'm not saying to not have a voice about certain things. But I am saying that there are things in this broken world that are always going to be broken. And so our hope needs to be beyond this life. So what if my secular worldview says, well, I'm going to try to make these crooked things more straight. Yeah, some of these things you're never going to fix. Imagine for a moment that you were on an airplane. And the airplane is going to crash. You got 6 minutes until it crashes, but it's kind of like coasting into a mountain. And so in the meantime, you're like, well, I need to go to the bathroom. So you go to the bathroom, and when you lock the door, you find that the light in the bathroom is not working. And you go to the bathroom, and you get out, and you talk to the steward person, and you go, do you know what? You guys need to fix your lights in this airplane. Let's go ahead and start fixing it right now. And then the steward person would say, well, this plane's about to crash. What's the big deal? I mean, they'd say it with more urgency than that because they're about to die, you know. But let's say that my perspective is I want to leave this world a better place. A world that I think is going to be going burned up one day without any God judging anything. This is just an airplane that's going to crash. What's the point of trying to make this a better place? You're trying to fix a light in a bathroom on a plane that's going to crash. So that's One problem with that, or that's one approach to the secular sense of trying to find meaning. But the other approach is that you accept death as a natural part of life. That the more and more I can understand that death is just a natural part of life, the book that I finished last night, by the way, she had one of the last pages, she talked about her daughter coming to her asking, what happens when we die? And the mom was like trying to figure out, well, what do I say about this? Because I don't believe that there's an afterlife. And so she had like this little soliloquy where she thought about what she could have said to her daughter, but she didn't say all of it. But what she thought to herself that she could say is that, well, when we die, your body will decompose and maybe it will feed a tree. And maybe that tree will grow up to be strong enough where you could attach a swing to it. And maybe a kid can play on the swing from the tree that you helped grow. So the secular approach to hope is that when I die, I would just like to know that my atoms are contributing to a playground for some kids. I mean, can you imagine telling that to a kid who's asking what happens when you die? What happened to grandma? What happened to grandpa? What happened to uncle or aunt when they passed away? Well, she's going to feed some trees. It's very dissatisfying. And you almost have to kill part of your brain to believe it. You have to dull certain parts of things that you just know are innately not true about how you think about the world. What is the Christian worldview? A lot better. 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 16 and 17. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God. And the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together. The quote went away. Then we who are alive will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. So we will always be with the Lord. Buddhism teaches that when you die, you just go back into the all-soul. Do you guys remember that blue Avatar movie with the blue people? Like, the planet's being destroyed, and so they have to, like, go out to different places. But every time they, like, cut a tree down, like, the blue people and the planet's, like, hurting because it's a pantheistic worldview that God is everything. Pantheistic worldview says that when you die, you go back into the all-soul, into this thing that is God. But you lose consciousness. You no longer get to be you. You just kind of get absorbed into this thing. This passage in 1 Thessalonians 4 says that we will be caught up together. That you still get to be you after you die. You still get to be you, but in a perfected state. Doesn't that sound a lot better? That when I die, I still get to be me. And when Jesus comes back, I still get to be me, but perfected. And it's not just that I get to be me, but in verse 17, that we get to be with them, other people who have passed away in the Lord, a great reunion. So there's going to be, I still get to be me, you still get to be you, we get to all be together, but in verse 17, we all together get to be with the Lord, who is the God of all comfort, he's the perfect father, he's the good shepherd, he's the God of peace, he's the God of grace, he's the redeemer, all these things that are said about God. We don't want to just have consciousness after we die. You get that in hell. We want to have love after we die. And we get to be with the God of all love. Transformed with all the people who have passed on that were saints, who will perfectly, finally love each other like we were always supposed to. Now, as I study these things with the skeptics, we're just comparing, which worldview is more emotionally satisfying? You've had emotional reasons for not believing in God. Can you see that there's a lot of emotional reasons you should want to believe in God? Does all of this prove Christianity to be true? No, you need the archaeological evidence for that. You need the logical arguments for God. You need those kinds of things. But does this become a kind of evidence that there's something about the Christian worldview that resonates with us? And maybe, just maybe, there is a God who designed me and knows what I need. Maybe you don't read all these skeptics and atheists and everything like that. How can you use some of this stuff for people in your workplace, if you don't know Thomas Nagel and you don't know all these other people that I quoted from? Can you at least ask questions like, okay, you're a secular person, so how do you find meaning in life? Okay, so you find meaning in life in your dog. Well, what if your dog dies? What about when that happens? What's your sense of identity? Have you ever realized that our mind kind of changes a lot? Why do you care about morality? Have you ever thought before that evolution is actually the exact opposite of caring for the weak and the poor? What's your hope? Is your hope really just that you're going to feed a tree one day? And just ask questions to people to help them think that maybe my worldview is really dissatisfying. And maybe that'll help them search for a higher answer because it does exist. We're about to sing the song Zion's Call. Jesus' call is for all to come to him and come to know his love and his saving grace in the sense of meaning and identity and morality and hope that he can give everybody. If there's anybody here this morning that needs encouragement or needs help, this is an opportunity to come forward while we stand and while we sing the song of invitation.
Zion's call sweetly rings over land.